everyone. It is Friday, November the 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, one school of thought, the downed Russian plane was inevitable.
Once the Russians had intervened in Syria, it was predictable that elements of particularly the Islamic State and other jihadist elements would carry out attacks against the Russians.
Also ahead, as winter approaches, concern about the plight of the Europe migrants and refugees, plus an honor for country music star Trisha Yearwood. Everyone, good to have you with us. President Obama was asked Thursday during an interview with KIRO radio host Dave Ross for his thoughts on whether a bomb destroyed a Russian jetliner over Egypt last week, killing all 224 passengers and crew.
I don't think we know yet. Whenever you've got a plane crash, first of all, you've got the tragedy, you've got the making sure that there's an investigation on site. I think there is a possibility that there was a bomb on board, and we're taking that very seriously. We know that the procedures we have here in the United States are different than some of the procedures that existed for outbound and inbound flights there, and we're going to spend a lot of time just making sure that our own investigators and our own intelligence community figures out exactly what's going on before we make any definitive pronouncements. But it is certainly possible that there was a bomb on board.
And British Prime Minister David Cameron spoke Thursday about restricting British aircraft from flying into and out of the Egyptian resort Sharm el-Sheikh from where the Russian flight originated.
We don't know for certain that it was a terrorist bomb. There's still an investigation taking place in Egypt. We need to see the results of that investigation. The reason we've acted before that is because of intelligence and information we had that gave us the concern that it was more likely than not it was a terrorist bomb. Now, if that turns out to be the case, and even before we have that confirmed, of course we'll look at all of the implications, because my job is to keep British people safe wherever they are in the world, and that means working with partners like the Egyptians to make sure that happens.
Cameron met in London on Thursday with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who, along with the Russians, say any theory that there was a bomb on board the plane is nothing more than speculation. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for attacking that jet that has not, though, offered any evidence to back up that. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina tells VOA's Victor Beatty if it's determined that the Islamic State was behind the aircraft's destruction, it will be only the first jihadist effort against Russia for its intervention in Syria.
Much more will be done against the Russians. They opened the Pandora box by their intervention in Syria, and they will unleash revenge. There will be revenge activities by Islamic organizations. So whether this one is the first or not, there will be more.
Do you suggest that perhaps this is one of the reasons why Russia is pushing fast for some sort of political solution in Syria?
That could be one of the reasons. I think that the Russians are having a strategy in Syria which is designed to show that, A, they can decide the situation militarily, but they can also bring about a political solution.
Egyptian President el-Sisi had indicated that the Islamic State initial claim of responsibility was merely propaganda. Mr. el-Sisi's image, has that been damaged? He claims that the situation in Sinai is under full control.
Look, the Egyptians have a sure interest here in minimizing the damage. It's a damage control activity on the part of the president, and one can understand it. Don't forget that tourism is a very important part of their economy, and tourism in the Sinai mostly. So if flights will be canceled now, or there won't be flights by a lot of international carriers to the Sharm el-Sheikh airport, that's a major damage to the Egyptian economy. So they have an interest in minimizing damage by pretending it wasn't a terror activity. If security in Sharm el-Sheikh airport was compromised, where else can it be compromised in Egypt? That's a real problem here for the Egyptians.
Joseph Olmert says that intervening in Syria, Russia has created a situation that invites jihadist revenge attacks. And Trinity University regional analyst David Lesh happens to agree.
It had to come in some form, in my opinion. That it happened in the Sinai Peninsula was somewhat unexpected. But once the Russians had intervened in Syria, it was predictable that elements of the, particularly the Islamic State and other jihadist elements who, you know, made up of such groups as Chechens and others who had been wanting to kill Russians for some time, would carry out attacks against the Russians, either Russian troops or installations or whatever. And I think that will come. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And I think the interesting point now is what will the Russians do? You know, when the evidence mounts that this was an attack that was precipitated by Russian military interaction, will they enhance and increase their military footprint in Syria? And is this the beginning of the quagmire in which the Russians will get themselves into that many people have predicted? You know, so I think the Russians are, and Putin is in particular, is very much concerned over this and very much concerned over what will likely be increasing attacks against Russian interests, not only in Syria, but as if this proves to be the case, Russian interests outside of Syria and in Russia itself. And will this compel Putin and the Kremlin to increase their military footprint in Syria? Will it compel them to draw back?
Russia's involvement only extends about a month, their air campaign really beginning in earnest on September the 30th. Were you surprised how quickly the IS took off after Russian targets?
I'm a little surprised that it was IS, because as we know now, the most of the Russian strikes until this time have been directed at non-IS opposition to the Assad regime. There have been a few attacks against IS positions in Syria, but you know, 95% of the Russian airstrikes have been against Jaish al-Fatah, the Army of Conquest, and other elements that have been most threatening to the Assad regime. I think what IS is doing is looking at this as an opportunity for recruitment, looking at this as a propaganda victory. You know, the jihadist playbook for al-Qaeda and in the Islamic State for years has been to draw the U.S. and or Russia or any other Western great powers in, and just to create chaos. And you know, the Russian intervention was a godsend in many ways to the Islamic State. It adds another target. It adds another recruitment opportunity, particularly from Central Asia and other, you know, former, you know, Soviet republics, and from elements, the Muslim elements within the Russian Republic now.
As David Leshin, he says if the Islamic State is found to be responsible for downing the Russian aircraft, it will be further incentive for Russia to seek a political solution in Syria. Still ahead, Syrian rebel leaders suspicious of those peace talks. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Also in the news, political opposition leaders and rebel commanders in Syria say the international diplomatic initiative to end the civil war in Syria will fail until it clearly establishes that only President Bashar al-Assad must go, but also an inner circle, and most of the country's feared intelligence services must leave office as well. Jamie Detmer is following the story.
Political opposition leaders and rebel commanders for 4 years have been trying to oust President Assad, and they're in no mood to compromise. They're suspicious of the international initiative to find a political solution to the war that has left 250,000 dead. They fear that Assad backers Russia and Iran will wear down the Western countries. And they say talks that started last week in Vienna shouldn't extend indefinitely. The talks involved 17 nations, including the US, Russia, and Iran. Opposition leaders say Tehran should only be allowed to continue to participate if it accepts the UN-sponsored 2014 Geneva communique, which states Assad should relinquish power. Nagam al-Ghadri is vice president of the main Western-backed Syrian political opposition group, the Syrian National Coalition.
We don't ask that Iran won't attend, but we ask that Iran should, for example, admit Geneva communique, for example, that there will be no future for al-Assad.
She says there's increasing distrust between the SNC and the Western powers. SNC politicians view the talks as a maneuvering by the international players, and they say that without either the SNC's participation or the Assad government's, the negotiations are futile. Al-Ghadri says the SNC's main goal remains.
From day one of the TGB, the transitional government body, no Bashar al-Assad. If there's a period between signing the agreement and day one of the TGB, Bashar might be in that period. We don't mind.
Some of the countries involved in the Vienna talks envisage several months of a preparatory period between a peace deal and a new transitional government. Zakaria Malahafi is a spokesman for the Rebel Alliance Army of Holy Warriors. He says the fighters inside Syria will never accept Assad remaining during a transition, nor will they accept any member of the Assad regime's inner circle remaining, or the intelligence services, because they have blood on their hands. Few Syrians, politicians, activists or fighters, believe a peace deal is possible at this stage. They note the dispute between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Tehran has threatened to withdraw from a planned next round of talks, and argue the circumstances are against a political solution, especially now Russia has entered the fight to buttress Assad's government. Bassam al-Kuwaiti is a political activist who knows the thinking of opposition politicians and top rebel commanders.
We've seen it throughout history. Political solution does not come without credible threat of using force. Except if we are talking about surrender to the regime or dividing the country. And both are unacceptable. So basically, nobody believes in a real political solution in the current circumstances.
With the death toll rising, the prospects look grim for a deal. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Gaziantep, Turkey.
UN Refugee Agency has announced the launch of an appeal of $96 million for new funding for refugees and migrants who are en route to Europe from Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere. And this comes as the harsh winter conditions are approaching. UNHCR says the winter weather is likely to make the suffering worse for the thousands of refugees and migrants landing in Greece and traveling through the Balkans. Their new winter plan anticipates up to 5,000 arrivals per day from Turkey through November of 2015 and February of 2016. Adrian Edwards is a spokesperson for the UNHCR. He speaks now with VOA's Kim Lewis about what the requested money will be used for in the coming months.
This money is essential for being able to deal with the still enormous numbers of people arriving in Europe by sea, even in difficult weather conditions seen over the last few weeks. We've had more than 750,000 arrivals by sea in 2015. This plan covers four winter months, starting immediately through to the end of February. It's aimed at doing several things. One, improving shelter so that people have somewhere, exposure to the elements can be reduced. We're looking at transportation needs too, because people are walking, making very difficult journeys over land, obviously the dangerous journeys they're making by sea, providing hot drinks, food, and then all the things that you need to support large numbers of people, water heaters, septic tanks, arrangements so that there is proper sanitation, so we don't have another kind of health or humanitarian crisis. So these really are emergency measures to do everything that can be done in extraordinarily difficult circumstances in Europe to help refugees and migrants through this coming winter.
How many refugees and migrants do you all foresee in the coming months?
At present, numbers of people crossing from Turkey to Greece have been rising. We had 218,000 people making that journey just in October. And at the moment, there isn't a clear sign of that trend changing. So we're looking at arrivals at the range of about 5,000 people a day over the coming months. And this plan is set to provide help up to that amount. But obviously, if the situation changes, we see more arrivals or dramatic reductions in arrivals, then the plan will have to adapt accordingly.
How are the European countries coping with this large influx of people?
At the moment, Europe's still struggling to come to a united and common approach to this. Enormous efforts are being made at key points along the journey that people are taking. There have been thousands of people arriving daily on the Aegean Islands in Greece and people walking by foot, taking other forms of transport to get through Europe. Enormous community and other help along the way. But at government level and at political level, that's where the struggle has been, because an influx of war refugees and migrants on this scale really requires a joined-up collective international response. It's too big a problem for one country to deal with it alone. And so far, measures to bring about that united approach to it have been making slow progress only. A lot of things that have been agreed to by Europe still at this stage need implementation before we'll know whether these plans work.
In the meantime, once the migrants and refugees reach these countries, what are they actually doing in terms of, are they being registered? Are they seeking employment? What are they actually doing at this time?
Well, once people arrive in the countries where they're heading to, and at the moment they have been heading towards Germany, Sweden, Austria, and a handful of other places, but once they arrive, there's this work to be done in receiving people, looking at their claims to refugee status and looking at their needs. And it's very important that people and their needs are looked at properly. It's important for Europe to know who is a refugee, who isn't, for example. On arrival in countries, people are going through initial reception and then they're being brought out to localities, locations around the countries where they're going to and looked after there. But it's still very early days, if you like, in establishing a formal and longer-term process for this. So it is a struggle for receiving countries at the moment. Even the biggest of these, Germany, for example, alone, we don't see Germany or any other country being able to successfully deal with this. It really does demand that there is this wider solution to it in Europe, and also with help from other parts of the world too, including in support help for countries, the regions where refugees are coming from, and resettlement of refugees to help share this huge international burden of record levels of people forcibly displaced globally today.
It's Adrian Edwards. He is the UNHCR spokesperson, and he was speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis, who is host of our program, Africa News Tonight. The ongoing UN envoy for Libya, outgoing that is, has urged that country's rival leaderships to stop blocking the democratic process and to vote on a political agreement that lays out the composition of a future unity government. Bernardino León told the UN Security Council in his final briefing that in recent weeks there has been progress toward resolving outstanding issues such as representation of the parties in the new government, but that there have been no formal acceptance of that agreement. The General National Congress and its allied militias took control of the capital, Tripoli, last year, sending the internationally recognized House of Representatives to the eastern city of Tobruk. The two rivals have been stuck in a spiral of violence that has contributed to the refugee crisis in Europe and led to the rise of Islamist extremists in Libya, including the self-proclaimed Islamic State. It is time now to check out what's trending online about one of my favorite foods, donuts. Yeah, indeed. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here. Hi, G. Tell us all about National Donut Day.
Hi, Steve. Yes, Thursday was a National Donut Day here in America, but so was the first Friday of June. So, understandably, that got a lot of people confused.
So this is the second National Donut Day this year. What are people saying on Twitter?
American celebrity Vanessa Hudson sent out this tweet. Wasn't it just hashtag National Donut Day? That tweet seemed to resonate with people. More than 400 people shared that tweet, and more than 1,000 people liked it. Her handle is at Vanessa Hudson's, H-U-D-G-E-N-S. Another user named Danielle Sandler also wrote, didn't we already have hashtag National Donut Day? What's up with all these quote-unquote days dedicated to getting type 2 diabetes? Almost 80 people liked that tweet.
like, certain that not everybody is complaining for an excuse to have a treat. So, gee, why are there two of the same days?
Good question. Online news aggregator Huffington Post tried to answer that. Its Twitter account, @HuffingtonPost, sent out this tweet and shared a link to an article. Hashtag National Donut Day is in June and November. But why? Steve, based on the article, the summer holiday is the more legitimate one. The June National Donut Day was established by the Salvation Army back in 1938. That was to honor female volunteers who made donuts for soldiers serving overseas as a way to boost morale. The article reports that effort led to the American soldiers using the slogan, "Donuts will win the war."
And what about the National Donut Day in autumn? What's that all about?
Sorry, but this one is completely fabricated. It's made by a National Food Council as a way to sell more donuts. And judging by the mentions on Twitter, that trick seems to be working well. Looking at the Topsy Analytics website, almost 40,000 people use the hashtag National Donut Day in the last 24 hours. Steve?
Many thanks to you, G. I think I'll have a donut anyway, even though type 2 diabetes might be in my future. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can always find G on Twitter if you'd like. She's at G. Abby Lee, and you can follow us, International Edition, on Twitter. We're at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Nigeria has Africa's largest economy, but it's not much of a coffee-drinking country. But the co-founder of Cafe Neo smells a coffee consumer market. But there are hurdles to face, and Ngozi Dozie says his company gets more of its coffee beans from other African countries than it does from Nigeria.
It's more expensive because the logistics of bringing it here are actually more expensive than getting it from Rwanda. And this is another challenge that we face.
The Nigerian middle class is on the rise, and that means more disposable income. Ben Iorda is a digital marketing consultant who says a coffee house in Lagos is an idea that he thinks will do well.
I think it's different. I think it's one of the things that is needed, especially in Lagos.
Cafe Neo has 3 locations, but plans to expand to 30 more coffee houses in the next 5 years for what they hope will be a growing coffee culture in Nigeria. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. You know, big country music star Trisha Yearwood was recently honored with a special award in Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Well, VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk about it all.
If you've heard of artists like Taylor Swift talking about licensing fees and royalties, chances are you've heard of ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. They help ensure that its members are compensated for the use of their music, whether it's via broadcast or live performance. ASCAP also celebrates its top members in a series of annual award shows in various music categories, including country. This past Monday, the ASCAP Country Awards took place, and Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to tell us all about it. Well, Nikki, even though it was the ASCAP Country Awards, pop artist Justin Timberlake and former President Jimmy Carter were a part of it.
Yes, Sarah. Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Carter were there to honor country music icon, singer, actress, and author Trisha Yearwood with the prestigious Voice of Music Award. Many of us know her from her big crossover hit, How Do I Live, from the movie Con Air. So Justin Timberlake is a Tennessee native, so he was raised around country music, and he's been a Trisha Yearwood fan. So he honored her with an extensive speech emphasizing her music accomplishments. So multiple award winner, including 3 Grammys. She recently released her 12th studio album. She has an extensive list of hits. As an artist, Justin said, and this is true, that Trisha has given young women a voice through song, with powerful lyrics of love, loss, and staying true to yourself. And former President Jimmy Carter, a fellow Georgia native like Trisha and Habitat for Humanity supporter, actually presented her with the award. And he personally knew her and her husband, Garth Brooks, especially as volunteers for Habitat for Humanity. And he said that Trisha is actually one of the best Habitat for Humanity volunteers he has ever seen. He said she's always on top of the scaffolding and she's doing a lot of the dangerous things, he said, that make a lot of men like him ashamed. But overall, bravo to Trisha Yearwood. This is an award well deserved. There was a great music tribute to her as well with Lady Antebellum, Reba McEntire, and Trisha's daughter, Allie Brooks, performing.
Wow, that just sounds great. Well, who else was honored at the event?
Well, Sam Hunt was honored with Songwriter Artist of the Year Award, and his song Leave the Night On was named ASCAP Song of the Year. And Ashley Gourley received the Songwriter of the Year honor.
Well, the coveted Country Music Association Awards happened this week as well.
Yes, it's like award week heaven.
Okay, well, we'll have to stay posted. You can catch Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach her on social media at VOA underscore music on Twitter or simply VOA Music on Facebook. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
And tell me now, how do I live without you? I want to know, how do I breathe without you? If you ever go, how do I ever survive? How do I?
Yeah. Nice song from Trisha Yearwood. One other story for you here. Actor-singer Will Smith says he's ready to get back out on the road. On the Ellen DeGeneres TV program, Smith says that he's planning to launch a tour with DJ Jazzy Jeff. Grammy winner will also be working on some new music, he says. Smith said he hasn't had much of a chance to tour because of the success of all of his programs that he's been in, movies, TV, everything. Well, he's made headlines last month when he appeared on a remix to Colombian band Bomba Estéreo's song Fiesta. And it turns out that Will Smith will be performing the track with the group at the Latin Grammy Awards on November the 19th. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council is supporting an African Union, or AU, decision to investigate human rights abuses in Burundi. The 15-member council said in a unanimous statement issued on October 28 that it was deeply concerned by the continued rise in violence in Burundi following the re-election of leader Pierre Nkurunziza. The United States welcomes the United Nations Security Council's presidential statement on Burundi and the council's continued attention to this crisis. Like the AU's communique of October 17, the Security Council statement put particular stress on the urgency of convening an inclusive inter-Burundian dialogue among the government and peaceful stakeholders within and outside the country. As such, the Security Council reemphasized the importance of the mediation efforts led by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni on behalf of the East African community and as endorsed by the AU. The United States stresses the Security Council's call for any dialogue to be inclusive and represent the voices of the citizens of Burundi, said U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby. He said the U.S. also welcomes the Security Council's strong condemnation of all violations and abuses of human rights and acts of unlawful violence committed in Burundi, both by security forces as well as by militias and other illegal armed groups, and its expressed determination to seek accountability for the perpetrators of such acts. Mr. Kirby noted that the U.S. is encouraged by the leadership of the United Nations in addressing the ongoing crisis in Burundi, particularly through Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's public offer in his October 27th statement of any support necessary to advance the implementation of the measures agreed upon by the members of the AU Peace and Security Council. The United States stands ready to support the AU, the EAC, and its designated mediator, President Museveni, and the citizens of Burundi to urgently conduct such regionally mediated dialogue outside of Burundi, which represents the best path forward to resolving the insecurity which has plagued the country since President Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term in contravention of the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.